This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence. Today we have a treat. There's been 2 weeks without a show, and I just want you to know that I've been not forgetting you, but thinking about having Don Alexander on the show. And finally, we are sitting in his lovely little cottage in England, and I have the pleasure of interviewing Don, and you have the pleasure of listening to his stories, which are vast, many, and beautiful. Don, thank you, and welcome to the show. I'm so happy that we are here together.
Thank you, Phyllis, and I feel quite honored and equally happy.
Mm-hmm. Now, you're going to have to get closer.
Okay.
Yeah, that's good. Now, Don, I'd love for you to start by telling your Reiki story. I don't know where it starts, but please.
Well, I think that my Reiki story begins before Reiki.
Okay, that often happens.
Yes. I've been interested in healing. I'm interested in people.
Uh-huh.
And if we're interested in people, of course, we're interested in people's problems, troubles of all kinds, mm-hmm. physical and mental, emotional, and what have you. So
that's right.
I can't be with people without taking an interest in what's going wrong in their lives and seeing if there's any way that, you know, I can be of help there.
Right.
Yeah, so I'd had a long trail from quite early years on my spiritual path. And that had brought me to looking at various healing forms, psychic healing and so-called alternative medicine and uh-huh. what have you. And I've been interested in all of this since I was quite young. I suppose the age of 16 I really started. And I got into meditation because, mind is the master.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember the Buddha saying that mind comes before all, all things, including matter. And so if we don't like the way that our body feels, then first we should look at the way that our mind is treating our body. And then after that, look at the body itself, the physical.
Mm.
And so this has been an interest of mine for a long time. And I had the great good fortune and blessing to live with spiritual masters in the Far East, in India, Thailand, Singapore. And so being with these people and spending time with them and feeling their hearts,
mm-hmm.
that, as it were, primed me for the reception of Reiki when it came, which was 1983.
Mm-hmm. Wow, and that's early.
Yes, and in England it was very early because there was almost no one teaching.
Right.
I think there was just one teacher and from the Radiance Technique.
Yes.
But I had to wait from 1983 when I first had a Reiki healing treatment to 1985 when I could import my own Reiki master.
You could import your
yes,
own Reiki master?
Yes. And
who was that?
That was David Jarrell.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes.
Great.
So I found he was traveling and I managed to get him to to spread his travel a little further.
Uh-huh.
And then I press-ganged half a dozen friends here because we had to pay for his expenses.
Right.
And so I was responsible not only for my own getting my own Reiki master, but also for several other people coming unexpectedly and almost unwillingly to Reiki in the first place. And then it was because I'd had experience in India, I'd had a Buddhist background.
Right.
And meditated in mountains and caves and done all the exotic things. Of course, really what happens is in your heart, and that doesn't need mountains and forests at all. But,
right.
You know, as a young man, I had to do the mountain and forest thing. And so then I heard the story of Usui and how he went up to a mountain. Especially I heard this little story that he'd visited a Zen monk, a Zen
right.
master, and the Zen master, as part of the final parting, was, well, go up onto the mountain and die.
Mm-hmm.
Something like that, words to that effect. And I wanted to know more. I also wanted to know what these amazing Sanskrit symbols were.
Uh-huh.
And so that led me a year later to travel to California, Southern California, to take a second degree Reiki class. And it was lovely. It was with Kate Nanny.
Oh, yes.
In North County, San Diego.
Yes.
And I was the only student. It was on Christmas Eve. And
that's very auspicious.
Very auspicious. And, of course, the symbols were drawn in the sand, where they could instantly be erased and drawn again. And it was very, for me, it was a very romantic situation.
Yes.
In which to receive Reiki. But what puzzled me was I couldn't see any Sanskrit symbols there.
I see.
I recognized, well, one looked, you know, very Japanese, and another looked, it could be from any kind of tradition.
Right.
So that set me on a quest, you know. After this story of Usui Sensei receiving his initiation, as it were, on the mountain, his deep inner heart connection with Reiki through Sanskrit symbols. Well, what were these symbols? And so that took me on a very interesting path.
Uh-huh.
Hmm.
And where did this path lead you? I'm interested.
It led me, first of all, I always ask, I have a photo of Usui Sensei, which travels with me.
Yes.
And I go down on my knees and ask him to teach me what I need to learn, you know. And he always does in one way or another. And I was in Florida, and this is 1988 or 89, and I was a very new master.
Mm-hmm.
And I was invited to go to France to teach, and I thought, well, why France? You know, I don't speak French, and but anyways, I went there and had a good interpreter. And on my very first class, there was a man, a Frenchman, who'd been interned in Japan during the Second World War. And so he was familiar with Japanese. As a little boy, he learned some Japanese. But he was a yoga teacher. And he was very familiar with Indian yoga systems from ancient times and Sanskrit symbols as used in India. And so he brought me a book along and said, Don, I can't give you the book, it's out of print, but, you know, borrow it for tonight and bring it back, please, tomorrow. I opened the book, and there were the two hands of the Buddha on a statue. And each one had a Sanskrit symbol on it. And the book, of course, gave a really good insight into the Buddhist tantric teaching, which came from India to China, and then through Kukai and others to Japan.
Right.
Yes, yeah, so, and then my question was, Well, what's the connection between these symbols and the Reiki symbols that we have? So I was a Buddhist, and I'd practiced in the simple Theravadin tradition, which has no symbols at all. So I was fascinated by these symbols. And then I got to realize when I meditated with just one or two of them, how utterly profound they are. That they are a window onto the, as it were, the heart of the universe.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And so then I thought, wow, okay, if these Sanskrit symbols are so profound, they take us right into the very heart of our being and our experience of mm-hmm. this that we call the world. Then Usui Sensei, in offering these Reiki symbols, must have come from the same profundity.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, these Reiki symbols, whatever they ultimately mean, is something very profound and takes us to the heart of ourselves and the heart of our experience of this that we call the world.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose that's been my prime focus and journey. It's like I did in the early days. I did a lot of Reiki healing practice, and I went into hospitals. And I had a busy practice. I also had a busy psychotherapy practice, and so this is why I was interested in the symbols.
Oh, I see.
So that
sort of a Jungian interest.
Well, that's right,
yeah?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, in other words, that I could be on one side of the room and work with a client and still bring Reiki in without having to find hand positions, because that's not what people are very comfortable with if they're, in bad psychological distress. You know, they perhaps don't need a man putting his hands over them if men were at the bottom of their problem in the first place.
Right.
So
right.
So this is another reason why I felt this great need, this urge to dive into the heart of the symbols. Yes.
Great.
And
great.
Of course they've been teaching me ever since, and they're still teaching me now.
Right. For me too. Yeah.
Mm, mm.
I never assumed they were Sanskrit, so that's interesting. I'll have to take that into my hat and
yes.
put it on and think about it for a
yes.
while.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always thought that the symbols were, I would say, from the consciousness of mankind. I just
mm-hmm.
will put it that way, because I think that, I had a few Jungian psychologists who
uh-huh.
took second degree from me.
Oh, really?
In the late 1980s. I don't know why I ran into this flock of
yes.
psychologists, and we had a great time, and
mm-hmm.
I was very close to them for about 5 years, and then they, you know, as groups do, they drift off,
yes.
and then you
yes.
don't see
mm-hmm.
them anymore. But they did a lot of research on the Reiki symbols and came to me with these different connections that they had found, and they were determined, of course, to find them in all different parts
yes.
of the Aboriginal cultures.
Yes. Yes.
So I was really struck by the, in some way, the commonality of the symbols in relationship to, like, the Mayan culture, the Aboriginal
mm-hmm.
Indian cultures, both in the United States and Canada, but also in, like, South America. And I don't know, it was a very interesting time for me. I really loved this whole conversation that I had with them. And,
yes. mm-hmm.
and I have always told my second degree classes that when I introduce the symbols, I say, well, there are a lot of questions that we can ask, but we don't have the answers to, or at least I don't have the answers mm-hmm. to. Mankind has always, it seems, from the very beginning, used symbology to create a bridge to the spirit world.
Yes, yes.
And how did they first have this idea?
Uh-huh. Yes.
That these symbols would do that?
Mm-hmm.
And did they imbue the symbols with so much of their own energy that then they became alive mm-hmm. and then became alive down through the generations?
Yes.
Our million, I don't know how many generations mm-hmm. there are from the symbols in France written on the cave walls.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Right? I don't know what generations we're in now. Mm-hmm. But those symbols, when you go to the caves, which I'm sure you have since you spent time in France,
mm-hmm.
They still emit this energy.
Yes.
Is that true?
It is true.
This is my theory, but I haven't actually seen them myself.
Yes.
Oh, good. Phew. Good to have confirmation. And I believe that there is something intrinsic of how we're connected to what I would call the spirit world or spirit.
Yes.
Or maybe each other. And that, isn't it interesting that a shape can somehow be the key
yes.
to this connection?
Yes.
I'm fascinated by that.
Yes. And of course it runs through in the West the old Masonic tradition.
Yes.
And of course the stone masons were the people who built the cathedrals. And the cathedrals are very symbolic.
Totally symbolic.
Absolutely. And of course this links me back to Japan.
Uh-huh.
And especially with Kukai.
Uh-huh.
The founder of the Shingon school, because the whole of Koyasan, which is a plateau on top of a mountain, and it's got little peaks around the plateau, and each peak represents some aspect of our psyche.
Uh-huh.
And so the whole mountaintop and each of the temples and each of the main buildings in the temples, they represent really who we are. And so if we're walking through that temple complex, I mean, it's huge. I mean, there's a village up there and there's many. It's a long way from one temple to another.
Uh-huh.
But it's almost as though as walking up there, that you're walking through your own psyche.
I see, right.
So this is, how can I say, another macro scale of symbology.
Mm-hmm.
So
exactly.
there's not only the symbols inscribed on the tombstones or the temple walls, but the whole environment is symbolic.
Right.
So it's and this is something I don't even pretend to begin to understand.
Right. No. Right. Well, I thought maybe in your practice you might have some hint, but I think that well, anyway, for me, it's really important almost that we don't have an explanation of why this works because it allows us to enter into this mystical relationship with spirit. So what I mean by that is not something that is a fantasy, but something that, well, my understanding of the definition of mystic. So for me, in researching this piece for me about mystic, that something is mystic when a human being is able to enter into this unknown realm that is not defined really by anyone
yes.
directly. So shamanistic rituals, for instance, lead the participants into a mystic experience,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Or Reiki, for me, leads people into having mystic experiences,
yes.
Either through receiving a treatment or through giving treatments or through the initiation process or through using the symbols.
Yes.
Yes? Mm-hmm. Is that true for you?
It is, yes.
Yeah.
And when you were speaking about the impossibility to actually define a symbol or to explain
right.
Very often in my classes I surprise people with a quotation from the Buddha which makes everyone sit up and think. And he said many times that however you believe a thing to be, it is for that very reason otherwise. And so that takes a huge hammer and hits on the head every belief that we hold as being mm-hmm. ultimately, you know, beliefs are what we use every day and,
right.
and we need them just to keep our lives together.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But when we look at ultimate meaning, no belief will ever go there, and however you believe a thing to be, it is for that very reason otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a great opening to my little project I'm uh-huh. embarked on.
Yes.
In Reiki, because I have this idea that it's time for us, meaning people who practice Reiki and who have an interest in deepening our understanding of this practice, because I feel like we're a very young practice.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are similarities to many other healing modalities because it's all about being human.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm. you know, I honor yes. the similarities.
Mm-hmm.
But this particular practice that originated with Mikao Usui is like, you know, 100 years old, something like this. And I feel that I'd like to feel that we're in the space of really bringing together our understanding from our experience, not from a belief system,
mm-hmm.
but from our experience of Reiki and in general, what does it do to our lives and what are the shifts that happen?
Mm.
And I don't know, I'm interested, first of all, to see if you have anything to say about my little project of bringing a cosmology together in the sense of being able to create a kind of platform for people not to create expectations of their practice of Reiki, but to create this foundation of understanding, for instance, that what does it mean when Hawaii Otakata said, have no expectations.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the precepts are a part of this cosmology. They're mm-hmm. the only thing actually that we can hang our hat on at
yes.
this point.
Yes.
So I'm just interested in, first of all, your idea of what cosmology is. Would it be useful in this time and place in our practice?
I think it would be useful for many people. See, people have so many different approaches
uh-huh.
to Reiki. I mean, some people just, they just put their hands on.
Uh-huh.
They trust.
Uh-huh.
And they smile. And Reiki works. You know,
right.
And there's nothing more to be said or done.
Uh-huh.
And that's beautiful.
It is.
And other people have the kinds of heads which disturb their simplicity, and I'm one of these. I'm one of these people.
You okay, know, I could raise my hand to that one.
Yes, and you know, I can't sit still without knowing something, even if, at my heart of hearts, I know that whatever I know is not going to be the final answer. It's not
mm-hmm.
going to be the absolute truth about anything.
Right.
But I've still got to know. And The search for knowing takes me along very interesting pathways.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure that this project could speak to many people.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, as you do, that when we practice without expectation, because to practice with okay, let's start again at this point.
Okay.
Because
rewind.
Yeah, rewind a little bit, because there's what I call the practice of magic and the practice of miracles.
Are they two different things or the
yes,
same?
Yes, this is my own personal distinction.
Okay, miracles
and the practice of magic.
Okay.
And the practice of magic is when you try, by whatever means, to change something. You have an idea of an outcome, and you do the equivalent of abracadabra, except that you use a Reiki symbol instead, and you get rid of a problem.
Yeah,
in other
that's
words,
your, that's your intention.
Yes, that's the intention.
Mm-hmm.
The other is just practicing and trusting, and you practice with love, and you also know that it's impossible for the divine to have a headache or toothache or bellyache. And that at the very heart of our being, who we are, is not just this little person with all its quirks and
mm-hmm.
Habits, good, bad, and all the rest of it. But there's something inexpressibly beautiful
mm-hmm.
at the heart of all of us, and I just use the word the divine for
yes,
that, whatever.
I think that's good.
Whatever. And the divine, or in theological terms, God, you know, you can't think of God needing to go to the medicine cabinet and getting an aspirin, you know, because the idea of a remedy to how can I say, the absolute perfection of all that is right now at this moment, you know, how can I say, whatever remedy we use is a kind of a magic, but when we trust our innate inability to be sick, incredible things happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I really believe that the symbols of Reiki point right to this place of that's utterly inexpressible, utterly whole, and never can be anything other than whole, because that's its nature. And yes, what can one say?
Interesting. Well, you know, I have two connections.
Yes.
When I was going through chemotherapy a few years ago, I somehow really got connected to the chanting of Deva Pramal and a lot of her Sanskrit, I guess they're Sanskrit,
yes,
chants
from
India.
Imagine,
yeah?
I would imagine so.
And
yes.
There's one that the translation, it goes something like, from the whole, something is removed and it remains whole.
Yes.
And I kept thinking about my surgery and that something was taken out of my body, but I remain whole. And it really comforted me, but it also gave me this profound experience of what we mean by wholeness.
Mm-hmm.
And then it took me back to what I remember Hawaii Takata saying in some of her, you know, renditions of her story, where Mikao Usui is speaking with the abbot about his experience on the mountain and about the energy that he had an experience, profound experience of. And that the abbot said, well, this is the energy that will allow people to become a complete whole.
Mm-hmm.
And this complete whole, I mean, it was always like this funny phrase for me, but it's really a Japanese concept, because you can be whole, but not completely whole. And then lately I've been working with trying to find in myself the ability to think regeneratively,
mm-hmm.
like to imagine that nature, well, this is what I believe is true, that nature, when left alone, can regenerate itself,
yes.
and it is a whole, and we are a whole within that whole.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And so this brings me back around to your whole.
Whole, yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, really nice.
Yes.
I had one question come up, though,
please.
In
yes.
your when you were mm-hmm. speaking. I was asking you, when you referred to love in the sense of when you treat with love, what does that mean for you?
Yes, and the best way I can begin with this
uh-huh.
is to describe my, and not just mine, but also a common experience with love, is that when I am less loving, I feel a greater distance.
Right.
And if I feel angry with a person, then I feel that there's an unbridgeable distance.
Right,
yes.
Exactly.
And the more loving I am, so the distance disappears. And I can only imagine what perfect love must be. Yes. And so... love, how can I say, it removes our experience of separation.
Mm, nice.
And now, this is us speaking of love, first, of between people.
Right.
But now, what about the world? You know, because sometimes the world gets up and batters us. You know,
right.
It feels as though the world is just having a... you know, a really bad morning or whatever. And it just knocks us about. And we get angry with the world and we get stressed and we get upset about things. And of course we become ill. Because as we know these days, that stress is the major cause of all illness.
Right.
You know, even each one of our trillions of cells, it gets involved in our stress.
Right.
And it can't function properly.
Right.
And so if we can learn to love what is happening to us, because it's absolutely what we need. Just as when I look into this mirror, the mirror tells no lies. You know, whatever I want it to show me back, mirror, mirror, on the wall, who's the fairest of them all? It won't say, Don, you are the fairest, because it'll show me every little pimple and wrinkle.
Right.
And every bit of myself that I don't want to show, but which does show, the mirror will reflect it back to me.
Right.
And the world, my experience is that the world is a reflection of me.
Mm.
And if the world is a reflection of me, then if I react angrily or with stress in any way, I'm going to make myself ill. It's not the world making me ill, but I'm going to make myself ill. And so now if I can learn to love what is happening, then I remove the stress and healing starts inside.
Mm-hmm.
And what I love is the image that I found on the mountains of Japan. Because where people go and practice austerities on the mountains, which they still do these days now.
Right.
There's always the figure of Fudomyo.
And who's
and
that?
And Fudomyo is, as it were, a symbolic deity. I mean, Fudomyo is, if you like, the side of God that we don't like.
Oh.
In other words, Fudomyo is very ferocious. He has ferocious eyes. He has...
I've seen him.
Yes.
Fangs.
And often one going down and one going up. And he looks
right.
Absolutely monstrous. Not the sort of person you'd like to meet on a dark night.
Right.
On a mountain or anywhere.
Right.
He carries a sword.
Uh-huh.
Which, of course, is to chop off your head.
Right.
Which means your ego, of course. He's surrounded by flames,
mm-hmm.
which are to burn you, but they're the flames of purification.
Uh-huh.
And then he has a noose, a lasso.
Oh.
Yeah, which is to catch your passions, which are...
Interesting.
Yes. And... he's there on the mountain because he represents the difficulties that mountain ascetics meet with in their practice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're not eating, and for much of the time you're not drinking, and if you do see water, it's just to bathe in it, cold, freezing cold, from the snow melt from the top of the mountain. This is very uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
Very uncomfortable. And Fudomyo represents symbolically that discomfort.
Mm.
And every little bit of it is our teacher.
Mm.
Yes, yeah, so everything that we don't like is just as much of a teacher to us as everything that we do like.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes more of a teacher because we have to sit up and take notice.
Right.
Whereas we often ignore our, you know, the teachers who come with a pleasant smile.
Mm-hmm.
We often listen and then do nothing about their teaching. But if we're in pain and suffering, then that is a wonderful teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And if we can say to that, ah, and we recognize that this is a reflection of me, so, does this seem to be taking us away from love? You know, love's just a convenient word. It's a convenient word for ending a sense of separation.
Uh-huh.
For me, this
right.
is what it means. And closeness. So, not only in human terms, but in terms of our world experience, which
right.
can be... devastatingly unpleasant at times. I mean, it seems that the world is knocking us all over the place, especially when we look and see wars and you know, places of conflict, and when thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people are dying.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the world doesn't seem very kind superficially when we look, but when we see that it's a reflection of me. Then I have to look inside myself to do something about it, and I can get to really appreciate the hardness, the toughness
mm.
of life. And I met an ascetic in Japan who just completed a 1,000-day retreat. That's 3 full years, day and night, in the mountains, and great austerities, a very difficult practice to follow. And I was asking him about Fudomyo. He said, well, he does look ferocious. But, you know, at the time of the greatest suffering, when you feel that you cannot tolerate the suffering, you can't bear it anymore, when you can actually get to love it, then Fudomyo changes absolutely. And his becomes the most beautiful face, the most beautiful figure, the most adorable being possible. So there's a symbol for us of the two sides of love. There's lovey-dovey, all cuddly and
right.
And then there's the the love which wants, if I can give it a personality,
sure.
It wants only one thing, and it wants our absolute happiness. It's not satisfied with us being halfway happy.
Uh-huh.
It
right.
doesn't want half of Don. It wants the whole of Don. Mm-hmm. It doesn't want half of Phyllis. It wants the whole of Phyllis. And it'll smack you in whatever way you need until you are here in the fullness of your love and wholeness. So, I don't know. I've been all around the mountains with this answer. I don't know if it makes any sense at all. But
well, it does to me. One of the things that I feel Reiki has taught me and is teaching many students is this quality of acceptance. You know, I think it's the first step to love.
Yes, yes.
Is the quality of saying, okay, I accept that this is in my life. Now, what is the gift?
Yes.
That's the second
yes.
step. Mm-hmm. The first step is to accept it. The second step is to put your arms out. And the
yes.
third step then, maybe, is to love it.
Love it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's what I've been thinking as you've been speaking.
Uh-huh.
And really makes a lot of sense to me. And that for me is one of the values or one of the cornerstones of our cosmology is that just as in the ancient days, teachings of Japan where everything was filled with divinity.
Yes, yes.
And that's the assumption.
Absolutely.
Then we have sort of fallen out of assumption of this divinity.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe in Christianity, the fall from grace. And now we're wanting to rediscover it for ourselves as human beings.
Yes.
I mean, mm-hmm. does that seem possible?
I think so. I think it is, yes. Yes. And this is something, the discovery has been made in all ages.
Right.
But by a few people.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems the majority still have the lesson to learn, so perhaps
yep.
in time we come back and back and back and you know,
right.
until we do learn.
Right.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, this brings me to something I never talk about,
uh-huh.
and that is an experience of enlightenment.
Hmm.
And because you're a Buddhist and you practiced would you say different, well, what's the word I want to say? Different facets of Buddhism or different sects of Buddhism or because I know that the Japanese Buddhism from the outside looks very different than, for instance, the Tibetan Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that it all comes from the teachings of Buddha.
Yes.
So that's where their
yes.
their connection is.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering,
yes.
you were mostly in Thailand?
In Thailand, yes. So they practice what is usually taken to be the early form of Buddhism.
Uh-huh.
Which is
very simple.
Very simple. Not developed. Um, uh, and not dependent upon the culture of the country that it goes to.
Oh, interesting.
Yes, and there are many forms of Buddhism which have developed in a particular country, such as Tibet, for instance.
Right.
Which is very Tibetan. It has very a very Tibetan expression.
Yeah.
And the Chinese expressions, there's several of them, are very Chinese. And Buddhism, when it came to Japan, was very Japanese.
Yes.
It was very... but the earliest form of Buddhism seems to be just looking at your experience and really becoming one with it. In other words, when you stretch your arm and you bend it, you're absolutely conscious, you're fully conscious. Because in that act of straightening and bending, it's possible to wake up. And the word Buddha is the one who, it just literally means the one who is awake.
Right.
You know, and in comparison with one who is awake, we're all asleep. And we're in a dream world.
Uh-huh.
And our dream world, the Indian, the Sanskrit world, is Maya. It's a world of dream and fantasy. That, in other words, it's a world that we've put together through our interpretation of our sense experience.
Uh-huh.
You know, I perceive my world in one way and you perceive the world in your way.
Right.
And but there are similarities, there are commonalities simply because we have similar senses.
Right.
But if we had totally different senses,
mm-hmm.
what kind of world would we experience?
Mm.
Yeah. And if we could increase, as the expression goes, increase the vibes, increase the vibratory rate of our senses, our whole nervous system, we perceive not the world as we normally see it, but we perceive it quite. I'm hesitating because there are some things that I'd love to speak with you about, and I don't know about putting them out, but because I don't want to make myself seem any way special, you know. Of course, we're all special, but that it's. Before I ever came to Reiki, I had a most wonderful experience doing rebirthing.
Right.
And in that rebirth session with the most remarkable lady from California, I experienced my mother, but as a being of pure love.
Mm.
As a being of light, it was there. She had the same form as she did. She was recognizably who she was,
mm-hmm.
but she was absolutely innocent, and innocent to the degree that innocence could not be in any way diminished.
Uh-huh.
Nothing could take it away because that's who she was. And I saw my father and one or two other people.
Uh-huh.
And when I saw myself like that, I just howled. It was too painful to bear.
Interesting.
The degree of absolute innocence was, I just howled for, I don't know, about half an hour. I just was...
deeply touched.
I was just a mess because it was too... beautiful for words.
Right.
Too unbearably beautiful. And then when I left the session I went outside, everyone had this nature.
Uh-huh.
Now, this is what I'm trying to say, that when the when something happens inside and we kind of maybe vibrate at a different level, uh-huh. our nervous system, so we're seeing through our physical eyes, yes, and we're seeing people and buses, cars and buildings, but they're not the same.
Right.
And the people are just too beautiful for words. I mean, they're incredibly, you know. And so I'm always aware that if I don't see people this way, I've really lowered myself. I've lowered my vibration. Uh-huh. I've lowered my heart. And it's something to do with coming back to this word love.
Right.
Whatever that may be.
Right.
You know. That when we are truly, truly loving unconditionally,
mm-hmm.
Even if that love costs us our life,
right.
to love so perfectly that nothing could,
right.
nothing could throw us off center. Then we see the world and everything in a different light.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when we see our disease coming back to healing, because that's what Reiki is all about, healing bodies, healing minds, healing lifetimes, when we move into this space of love, which I have to admit is very rare for me. I mean, it's not a space that I live in.
Right.
It's a space that I'm very conscious of not living in.
Right.
Because I don't want to seem in any way special or different, but just I use this experience as a touchstone for me. Mm-hmm. It's a touchstone. If we allow ourselves through loving to lift our heart, to lift our vibration rate,
mm-hmm.
the world that we see changes. The world that we live in changes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of Ho'oponopono. I don't know to talk too much about that from Hawaii.
Yes, we've had people on the show talk about Ho'oponopono.
Yes, mm-hmm. and where wondrous healing can take place when we take full responsibility for our world.
Right.
It's like the world is not separate from me. It's my world.
Uh-huh.
You, Phyllis, and everyone else and everyone listening to this program is my world and it's my responsibility.
Right.
So, again, coming back to love,
uh-huh.
you know, what in this context is love.
Right.
And if Reiki, as I believe, is an expression of love, you know, it asks more questions than it answers.
Right.
But it's for me a guideline.
Uh-huh.
It's for me a guideline in my practice.
Right. And so, in the Buddhist sense, then what is enlightenment in relationship
it's
to this?
It's just waking up. It's waking up.
And being love?
You can't avoid being love. But the Buddha doesn't use the word love.
Uh-huh.
And people get rather disturbed by this, that the Buddha didn't really speak so much about love. Because, as we said right at the beginning, that love is a complex...
Right, but it's sort of our vernacular right now.
It's a vernacular, yes.
To talk about other things,
yes.
like waking up.
Yes.
And people go, well, waking up, that's no big deal. But actually, yes. it is a big deal.
It's a big deal. Because
so let me
you could,
talk
you
about
could,
the big deal.
If you could really, if we could really wake up, I like that experience I spoke about during that rebirth session,
right?
Which I had. I suppose it was 1981, 82. I mean, it was kind of a while back when rebirthing was very popular in the world. And
but it really put out a profound effect on the whole world.
I mean,
it was amazing.
Yes, yes.
It is amazing, actually.
Yes, yes. And I did a lot and helped a lot of people through that medium. But what I did in that... see, one of the things that rebirthing does, it knocks you out of your mind.
Because
mm-hmm. you're breathing so deeply and so powerfully, and it takes you into an altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it does. And so the door is open then for you to experience whatever you need to experience mm-hmm. at that time.
Right.
And depending who you're with, like if you're with a very, here's that word again, if you're with a very loving rebirther, things happen differently from if you're with someone who is not so loving.
Right.
So you know, when we're not awakened in an ultimate spiritual sense, we can't even begin to speak about it. It's one of these ineffables. It's one of these inexpressibles.
Uh-huh.
As the Chinese say, he who speaks does not know, and he who knows does not speak. Because it's something that you can't put into words.
Right.
And you can't even have an idea about it, because ideas are always secondhand.
Right.
You know, there's immediate experience. I put my finger in a flame and it burns and I have an experience. And then later on I reflect on it and I have an idea about that experience.
Right.
Which is mixed with all sorts of other experiences.
Right.
But the direct experience, without any additions, without uh-huh. any that... as I understand it, is an awakened state. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And do you feel, sometimes people ask me if the goal of practicing Reiki is to become enlightened?
Yeah, I think that if... it's like if we can have that goal, and that would be the most misleading thing we could do, because we don't even know what enlightenment means. We don't even have the vaguest idea.
Right.
And to repeat the quotation from the Buddha, however you believe a thing to be, it is for that very reason otherwise.
That's
because
great.
Once our mind gets into the configuration of believing, it's already left
right.
the direct
right.
direct experience.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So this this piece that we covered earlier about becoming whole feels like a more feels like a natural place for us to go if
yes.
we wanted to have a goal.
Yes.
But in any seems like it would be very tricky to create a cosmology where there was an expected goal.
Yes.
Because
yes.
The goal then, well, one of the things that I try to get people out of is seeing that there is a goal in Reiki,
mm-hmm.
because there's this other, I assume, Buddhist saying something about it's not the getting to the goal, it's the path
uh-huh.
to get there.
Yes.
That's the
mm-hmm.
important part.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that's been proven in my case.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like I've gotten to my goals, but I have realized my dreams. And one of the things that I find quite amazing is that in the first, say, 15 years of Reiki practice, I realized all of my dreams for the for my life at that time. Mm-hmm. And the next 15 years have been living in the dream. So it's an interesting quality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it is. And, you know, many people these days speak about thoughts becoming things.
Yeah.
You know, it's the new spirituality, as it were, from the 1920s onwards.
Right.
And the science of mind and how you change your thoughts and change your life and change your world, etc. But there's something beyond that we can't even see. It's like we can only approach it on our knees. We go down on our knees, and symbolically, if you mm-hmm. like, which is to go down from your ego, go down from your ivory tower, go down from whatever you're holding on to as a final belief, mm-hmm. And to go down in absolute innocence and ignorance. You know, I don't know. Please show me. Mm-hmm. I've always done this with Mikao Usui, through a photo.
Right.
You know, but how am I supposed to handle this situation? How am I supposed
right.
to do this?
Exactly.
You know, show me, you know, mm-hmm. but just show me. And how do I work with this person who has come to me for healing, and yet what they don't want is to be healed? Mm-hmm. You know, some people, their greatest terror is to be healed. They don't, you know, for some reason they're absolutely terrified of losing their phobia or their whatever it is.
Right.
And so we go in a state of complete unknowing, but just trust mm-hmm. that what we're doing actually has its own wisdom. And and when we do either literally go on our knees, as they do on the mountains quite a lot, or when just in our heart of hearts we go down on our knees and we go forward with our unknowing, and from that place of unknowing and total openness and innocence we offer healing without any expectation, the most wondrous things happen. The most wondrous things. Wondrous. Yeah.
Well, Don, this was a wonderful hour. Thank you.
I'm sorry if I've been too diverse.
No, no.
So it's been my pleasure as well. And I've wanted for a long time to be able to sit down with you, Phyllis, and so this is beautiful in every way. Thank you.
Thank you. This is Phyllis Furumoto with Reiki, Balancing Form and Essence.